Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Marianne Kane, stage manager on Broadway.
Once upon a time,
Marianne Kane stage managed Into the Woods on Broadway, having previously worked as a stage manager on The Final Workshop. She also served under production stage manager Frank Hartenstein on Big River for most of its Broadway run. Additionally, she stage managed the original Manhattan Theatre Club production of Donald Margulies' What's Wrong with This Picture, featuring Madeline Kahn.
Working for the Dodgers, the producers, the Dodgers, on Big River, and had been assisting Frank Hartenstein, who was the production stage manager, and they were producing this other show, and Frank asked if I wanted to go along with them, and I said, yes, please. So that was my first, it was after the San Diego things had happened, but the first thing that I was involved with was the workshop in New York.
I was hoping you were going to say that. You know, you said you'd listen to some other episodes, so maybe you know that I'm obsessed with that workshop, that mysterious workshop. Now, I know Big River closed just like a month before Into the Woods opened. Were you doing double duty at that time?
No, I left. I left Big River a few months before it closed to start rehearsals for Into the Woods. And also Jonna Murray, who had been with the show before, my husband at the time, Chris Fielder, had been her assistant at the Merrily in La Jolla. So I knew her and, you know, admired her as well. So was very happy to get a chance to work with her.
And did Frank leave Big River a few months early together with you?
Yes, I followed him. So, yes.
Got you. Okay, so Frank says to you, the Dodgers are doing this Sondheim-Lapine show, Into the Woods. You've heard about it. Jonna worked on it. They did it in San Diego. It's coming to Broadway. And the first thing we're going to do is this workshop. What did you know about it at that time before starting that workshop? Do you remember?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing, of course, was that it was a Sondheim show. And I was, you know, I'd seen Sunday in the Park, so I knew a little bit about their collaboration. And I knew that Jonna had worked with James, you know, for a while, so she was friendly with him. You know, I just kind of knew that it was about fairy tales and that it interwove a lot of things, and that was it.
Yeah.
I knew they had done it in San Diego, you know.
And so my understanding of this workshop was that there was 2 weeks of rehearsals followed by the invited presentations. Is that right?
Yes.
And this is where it gets really hairy, separating out people's memories of what went down. But in your memory, was there more than one sort of performance presentation of the workshop?
I don't really recall. I mean, my biggest, this is petty, but my biggest takeaway was being in a room with Betty Buckley and having her sing and having it sound just like a trumpet. I mean, like this pure trumpet sound. That was, you know, I think my hair blew back, and that was an amazing thing to me, and not necessarily, you know, the chemistry, but just, gosh, that voice was really amazing. So, you know, it's not brilliant, but just what really tickled me.
No, you are getting to my sweet spot, because this is part of the reason, maybe the main reason, that I'm so obsessed with this workshop is that Betty Buckley is one of my all-time favorite singers, and one of my favorite things I ever heard Betty sing was Children Will Listen in the Sondheim celebration at Carnegie Hall, where she just blasted the roof. I mean, trumpet is the right word, because it's that kind of clarity and power, but it's just so beautiful and musical. And, you know, And so it was so tantalizing to me to know that she had done these early iterations of Into the Woods, and, you know, a role that I could very easily imagine her in, and can fantasize about what she would have sounded like. And from the little that she has spoken about the experience, I know that, you know, she was frustrated by the material that the witch at that time in the development had. She's talked about just really having the rap. And I certainly know that Children Will Listen and Last Midnight were added during Broadway previews, or maybe Children Will Listen was in the, from the first, you could probably tell me better than I know, from the beginning of the Broadway process, but that I believe Children Will Listen was not in the workshop that Betty did. So the, sorry, go ahead.
Children Will Listen grew out of Second Midnight. You know, they have those little interludes, First Midnight
yes.
Gone.
Oh, yes. Midnight Gone.
Second Midnight, Steve kept working on it, and it was the most beautiful thing that I ever heard. And it stopped the show dead. There wasn't any way to keep going after that. It was like so moving. And so they had to cut it in order to keep the show going. And then a lot of that was then salvaged and became Children Will Listen.
Yes.
At the end, which was great, but it was so moving because every single character came through and had, you know, had a piece of it. And it just accumulated to this devastating and moving meditation on parenthood and childhood and family and all of that.
Yeah. I've often wondered about this because there's the demo track of that song recorded with people that weren't in the cast, and John Cameron Mitchell and Maureen Moore and George Lee Andrews. That's on one of the, that's available in different CDs that were released, you know, of Into the Woods and Sondheim stuff. But I'm obsessed with that track. And there's even on YouTube recording from a Broadway preview of the Broadway cast doing that elaborate Second Midnight song. And so I wondered, because it does seem like there are so many sort of ballads in a row at the end of the show, going from No More into No One Is Alone into Children Will Listen, I wondered why they didn't, you know, I understand that they wanted probably to give Bernadette a solo because she's Bernadette, and the audience wants, you know, they've come to a Bernadette Peters musical, they demand, you know, I know I feel that way as an audience member, where are my Bernadette solos? But I'm surprised that there wasn't any more of that element of Second Midnight. Did you feel like there was something lost in the translation from Second Midnight to Children Will Listen?
It's a one person expression. It is the culmination of what the show has been, but the witch's experience in the show is different from Jack's mother's, you know, the experience that the character has. So whereas before it was a lot of little, you know, kind of jokes that then got really meaningful in, you know, where it was in the show originally in Second Midnight. So that changed, but
right.
As I said, the show you couldn't pick yourself up off the floor and keep going with the show after, you know, after that really moving experience. So, you know, it certainly worked better in terms of the show.
Sure.
But I was very blessed to hear them sing that.
Yeah. Well, everyone should check out that track. Okay. So getting back to the workshop though, Betty as the witch did not have Last Midnight. She didn't have Last Midnight. She had Boom Crunch, and she certainly didn't have Children Will Listen. I know when you talk about the trumpet voice, maybe you're talking about Boom Crunch, or are you talking about Stay With Me? Was Stay With Me in the show yet, in that workshop?
Yeah, I think it was. I think that he did rewrites on it But I think that it was there. They had that big, you know, the moment with her, the witch and her daughter.
Because and that was not in the show in San Diego. So I've often wondered if he wrote that for Betty Buckley in that workshop process.
I'm not sure. I think I think it was written for the character.
The character, sure.
Star, you know.
But I can certainly imagine how incredible her voice would have sounded, and her, you know, emoting, what, how powerful it would have been in that song. And then Boom Crunch, just while we're on Betty, although I want to get back into the sort of bigger picture of the workshop. But Boom Crunch, Paul Ford talked about Betty being unhappy with that song and really sort of pushing to try to change it in ways that I guess Sondheim or Paul Gemignani, you know, they Lopine didn't want to change it. And he referenced, I don't think he said Bernadette was unhappy with it, but that she had struggled with it, learning it, and that it was like a tremendous joyful relief when Last Midnight was delivered, however 11th hour that delivery came. What do you remember from the workshop about the process with Boom Crunch and Betty? Because I assume that now that you said Stay With Me was there, that your happy memories of Betty's trumpet-like voice must have been on Stay With Me rather than Boom Crunch.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that isn't a soaring vocal.
Yeah.
I don't have very specific memories of that. I mean, I was the assistant stage manager. I took the blocking and, you know, I was doing that part of the job. And just happy to be in the room, kind of, you know. And I didn't quite appreciate the jazz waltzness of Boom Crunch then, you know. I was just learning the, you know, the characters, what it did for the
yeah.
people.
On the, you know. Yeah. Well, so okay, let's go back because, so if it was a couple of weeks, I believe that in the first week, Betty had not been available. And so Suzanne Douglas, who was, I think, supposed to stand, who was standing by for the witch and Rapunzel and maybe Cinderella, was going on as the witch in the first week. And then in the second week when Betty was there, Suzanne Douglas was Rapunzel opposite Betty. Does that remember correctly to you?
That could be. I'm sure your research is better than my recollection.
I mean, it's just other people's memories, and so I mean, you used the word chemistry when you said, you know, that as much as you loved Betty's voice, you weren't saying there was good chemistry. I can imagine that if that was true, that she was gone the first week, that might have been like kind of starting on the left foot, so to speak. Not to mention the fact that most of the cast had just done a full production of the show with a, you know, extended run at the old, not just, I guess it had been 6 months or so, but they had done that and, you know, 8 shows a week for all those weeks. And here Betty was coming in essentially cold. Is that what you're talking about in terms of chemistry?
Well, I mean, the Chip and Joanna chemistry was so wonderful and strong, and they were so funny and brilliant. And I think that, I don't know, I wasn't privy to, you know, the discussions that went on. But I think that that Betty Buckley was trying to change things around her, and they already had built something that was very solid and strong.
Mm.
So I think it's like breaking into the club a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sound petty, but there was something really, you know, there was a real kind of family. They had built and were building this thing together. And I'm not sure that, the character of the witch was really one of the ensemble roles at that point. It wasn't a star turn. And I think that's maybe what she was looking for. She never talked to me about it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that may have been where there was tension.
That's interesting. I mean, it also seems like R.J. Cutler or David Warren, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting which one said this to me, but one of them had said that they had thought maybe a lesson coming out of San Diego was that regardless of who played the witch, that the character needed to have more material and be more of a starring role than it had originally been conceived. And so that would have seemed to be in support of Betty. So then just as far as you talked about taking notes on the blocking, was this like a fully staged presentation? I mean, is it sort of, reading choreography of like get up from your folding chair, go stand at the music stand, or was it like real staging?
I think it was semi-staged. I think that there was I may be wrong, but I think that there was a floor plan taped out on the floor, and there was some movement, and that's what I recall. But I could be wrong. I put in for the Broadway run. I mostly ran the understudy rehearsals and put in new people, and so I did a lot of that. So that could be informing that workshop that was there.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because, by the way, this was at 890 Broadway, which is the Michael Bennett Studios, the same place that you rehearsed the Broadway production. Is that right?
Right.
Is it likely that it was in the same studio at 890 that you would have had Broadway rehearsals in?
It could have been.
I have a little bit of an ongoing disagreement with Chip Zion, who really feels that... that Betty started rehearsals for the Broadway production, and then Bernadette replaced her after rehearsals had started. And I'm really certain that he's wrong and that Bernadette was there for the first rehearsal. And I keep saying to him that maybe the reason he thinks that is because you were in the same room with the same tape on the floor and it's all kind of jumbled together.
That could be.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm putting you on Team Ben on this one. Then it's semi-staged, maybe entrances and exits with some semblance of a set design delineated on the floor and tape. And you talked about Sondheim rewriting, you were talking specifically about Stay With Me, but was that the process throughout the 2 weeks that new material kind of like kept coming in over the course of that time?
That's an excellent question. And Paul Ford would know the answer to that. It was all new to me, the material. Yeah. So, I knew that they were working on it and that they were, adjusting things. So I don't know all what was added because I was still coming up to speed with what was there.
Yeah. One thing that seemed to remember was that there were multiple performances, whether it was, I think, two or three, there was some confusion. And that the point of the multiples was to see the different possibilities for the ending. He described it, he said, I guess I took him literally, but I guess he meant it jokingly, but that there was one where the baker's wife died, one where the baker's wife lived, and one where everybody died. And I guess he said what he really meant was where a lot of people died, not everybody. But he also wasn't sure if that was three separate full runs of the script or if it was like, you got to page 95 once and then did the last five pages three different ways.
I don't recall.
No.
I wish I did.
Other people have also remembered a really high pressure, like show business kind of A-list invited audience that, after these sort of 2 weeks in the room with just the team and the cast, all of a sudden it was Kevin Kline and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters, you know, not to mention presumably every producer in New York. Does that ring a bell?
I think there were angels there. It wasn't just us folks, right. But you know, I was still completely starstruck by working with Sondheim. So
yeah,
you know.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And you know, it's funny thinking about Sondheim in this moment because, like, I think a lot of, somehow it's very familiar to me, the idea of Sondheim in the most recent years, in the final years of his life, as this sort of, like, just godfather of musical theater, the most respected, most admired. Everybody from the entire spectrum of the industry just worships him. And, you know, it seemed like one after the other, there's just no end to the tributes and concerts and, you know, festivals. And I also sort of have an image of the sort of kid upstart in the 50s and 60s around Leonard Bernstein and Oscar Hammerstein and all those people who was, you know, going to change the face of musical theater, but hadn't quite done it yet. And so I'm very curious about this moment, Into the Woods, where Sondheim is still, you know, a virile, you know, middle-aged, you know, man, still certainly at the peak of his creative powers, very established, as obvious by the fact that you were, you know, starstruck by him, but also still really in it, still really doing it. What was his energy like in the room? What was he, how was he with you and with Frank and with the other collaborators and cast members?
Oh, he was definitely a working theater professional. I mean, no question about it. He understood and liked the business, and he was, you know, funny and friendly and busy. You know, he was working very hard, but he, you know, laughed loudly at, you know, jokes that landed in run-throughs. And he was just very much there and part of the process. You know, I think he really, really loved actors and singers and musicians, and he respected the whole, you know, theater process and the craftspeople. But it wasn't like I was, you know, best friends with him or anything. I didn't have much direct contact with him. He was very busy doing the work that he was doing. But no, real, you know, he didn't act like he was unapproachable.
No.
At all. He was doing the work.
And like, you know, just did he kind of roll in just kind of by himself, sleeves rolled up, like, you know, carrying the New York Times kind of a deal? Or like, was there a sort of, you know, team around him of like assistants and handlers and whatever, you know?
I don't think he wasn't like coming in with an entourage.
No.
He had an assistant. I think his name was also Steve, but I could be wrong.
Was Steve Klar.
Yeah. You know, who was often there, but you know, he didn't come to the stage manager's table first. He was working with, you know, with Paul Ford and Paul Gimignani and with the actors. And, you know, it was very, very collegial relationships that they had. But there was, you know, he was doing a lot of big work.
Yeah. Did they sort of tag team that work? Like, you know, would the actors only get notes from James or only get notes from James and Paul Gimignani? Or were there times when Steve would be communicating something himself, or did Steve go whisper it to somebody and then they, you know, what was that process like?
There were lots of conversations with actors, and I don't remember like note sessions where, you know, they were, you know, like having disagreements in front of the kids or, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I think it was, there was the, you know, amazing musical team. Mm-hmm. I think that Steve and James had, you know, lots of conversations and, with that. So I don't remember. I think there were musical note sessions that Steve participated in. And then there were the, you know, general note sessions. But
and then, like, in terms of, I mean, you talked about him loving actors and all that. Another thing that I'm sort of mystified by is Burke Moses, who, until I started doing this podcast, I had not known that he'd been involved in Into the Woods at all. Chuck Wagner played Rapunzel's Prince at the Old Globe Theater. Chuck mm-hmm. Wagner played Rapunzel's Prince on Broadway. When I found out you all had done this workshop, I 100% assumed Chuck Wagner played Rapunzel's Prince in the workshop. So, of course, I found out that Burke Moses had been cast as Rapunzel's Prince in the workshop and for Broadway, as I believe everybody's contracts were, I guess maybe with the exception of Betty. I understand that everybody had signed two different contracts simultaneously for the workshop and for Broadway. Maybe with the exception of Betty, I don't have clarity on whether she actually had a Broadway contract at any point. There's different versions of that story, but Burke certainly did. Then I guess this Bob Westenberg thing happened where I guess Bob says they knew his schedule, but somehow they hadn't realized he had to be in DC to do the matinees of, I think it was the Crucible that he was doing. So they said, don't worry, we'll have your understudy, Burke, do the Prince and the Wolf in the workshop and we'll see you on Broadway, basically. And then Burke's understudy, Jeff Blumenkrantz, would be Rapunzel's Prince. And according to Burke, he failed so badly and Sondheim and Lapine were so unhappy with him that, in this role that wasn't even his role, in this role that he was the understudy to, that he was fired and not taken to Broadway. And, or I guess, you know, completed the workshop, but was fired from his contract to then do the Broadway production, which was happening very soon. Do you have any insight on that? I mean, Burke was so generous in talking to me about it, but it was all sort of through the lens of an actor's perceptions about their own talent. You know, as a third party, you are not Burke Moses and you are not James Lapine. Was it that they weren't happy with his performance, or was there a personal dynamic? Did it seem, was it a surprise when he was let go?
I remember only that James had a very specific vision for how sexual the wolf was to be, that it wasn't supposed to be a subtle thing, which, you know, definitely when that costume came and there were genitals, it was, you understood the degree to which he was talking about it. Yeah. And I think that may have been the, divide as that how far, he wanted him to go as the wolf, but I wasn't privy to those conversations. I just, you know, I was grateful and lucky to have the job and, you know, yes, sir, how high is my motto.
But so you, takes. It wasn't like a big drama that dominated the proceedings. Like, it was a surprise when Burke Moses was let go for the Broadway production.
I, you know, wasn't aware of it, if it was a thing.
Right. It didn't upstage to the rest of the room what was going on.
Not that I noticed.
But the Betty situation was more conspicuous for everyone in the room.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the stakes were pretty high in who was going to be the witch.
Certainly, right. Regardless of even what happened, just the amount of spotlight on that. When did you find out that it wasn't going to be Betty? Do you remember?
I think just when we got the cast list for who we were going to be working with. I think that's how I knew.
So then Bernadette was on the list. So, I guess you only had, was it like 3 weeks off between the workshop and the first Broadway rehearsal?
That sounds right. Yeah, it wasn't.
So that was a pretty tight turnaround. Paul Ford and Danielle Ferland talked about, presumably within that 3 week period, a reading at someone's townhouse where it was the whole cast, including Bernadette, where I guess Paul knew Bernadette was going to be there because he had coached her on the music prior to that. But most people got there that day and found out, oh, Bernadette's playing the witch. Do you remember that reading?
Yes. Not very many specifics of it, but I think that was definitely the first time that I had met Bernadette.
What was the purpose?
I think it was another Angels.
Like a backers audition.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So that's pretty late in the day to still be raising money.
I could be wrong also.
Yeah. But other people, like Jeff Blumenkrantz specifically, talked about backers auditions and stuff. And it's not something I think we think of, because nowadays producers are investors. And so they don't really do backers auditions in the way they used to do, or they do workshops and people come. And also we think of Sondheim as being, you know, somehow just how dare you not invest your money sight unseen on Stephen Sondheim. But that makes sense. I mean, it was the 80s, you know? And obviously once they had Bernadette, it would be an amazing way to get the investors committed, is for them to get to see her. That makes sense. People have talked about how the addition of Bernadette to the cast is just sort of a magic ingredient that makes everything come together harmoniously with professional polish. Did that just feel, was that the feeling in that in real time?
Well, it's just hard not to love her.
Yeah.
She's a very, you know, hardworking and charming person. So I don't think anybody felt threatened by having her there. You know, they were working on the show, and she was doing, you know, her job, and, you know, certainly delivering at every rehearsal. But she was a very personable, you know, trying to get in those lyrics.
When a person's personality is personable.
Yeah. So I think that is maybe what the magic was, but
yeah,
you know, they were working on the show. That was the main thing, and kind of just figuring out what it was. But I think everybody enjoyed working with her.
And then, so once that Broadway rehearsal process started and it was the actual cast all together, Tom Aldridge and Chuck Wagner and Pamela Winslow arrived from her college musical that they let her have the workshop off so she could do. So funny. I know that Last Midnight came late in previews.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that second midnight was only in one or a very small number of performances, which I believe were early previews. So presumably, presumably Children Will Listen came in previews, but early in previews.
I don't think it came so early in previews.
Oh, okay. So that was later as well.
So, yeah, they could. And then, you know, I think it came kind of late in previews. I missed that second midnight for a while.
Oh, wow. So second midnight was cut. And then there was a period of time when there still was no Children Will Listen.
Right.
What about the sort of it's not a reprise, but the sort of preview snippet of Children Will Listen that comes when the witch sings Lament, which is really the reprise of Stay With Me in Act Two when Rapunzel dies. And then, you know, no matter what you say, children won't listen. Was that always there?
I think that came out of the cut second midnight. So I don't think it was there the whole time. I think it was added. That was part of the, you know, treasure trove of gems that were part of that song.
Okay, so Last Midnight came very late in previews. Children Will Listen came somewhat late in previews. Even the little Children Will Listen snippet in Lament came during previews. So what did you all do for those weeks of rehearsal at 890 Broadway before you started tech? It wasn't new material, because it seems like you were doing basically, maybe there was little nuance adjustments, but it seems like you basically did the script from the workshop in those rehearsal weeks.
It wasn't fully staged in the rehearsal. So there was all of the staging and working out the, you know, business and all of the things that you figure out in rehearsal, where props have to be and how, you know, how it's going to go.
I didn't mean to imply you all slapped off, but I mean, but material wise, rehearsal process was about staging this show that was essentially the piece that had come out of the workshop.
I think that, that James was working on the script a lot too. I think they just were putting it on its feet and rewriting and, you know, working. There's a lot to do to get all of the music ready and, you know, it's
certainly process. And for people that only know the modern process where, you know, the book writer's assistant is in rehearsal with their laptop and changes are, you know, if any changes that are made in real time go in there just as they would after hours. And then that is, you know, uploaded to a server somewhere that someone whose job is, you know, the script is able to immediately generate collated copies that are seamlessly integrated into the scripts people have because the pages, you know, are clearly proportionally numbered at the bottom with where they get inserted and what they replace. What was that like in 1987?
Well, I think each new version was on a specific color page.
Mm.
So they put in like the green rewrite or, you know, then they were dated at the bottom. But, you know, it's always a lot of work to make sure that the pagination works because, you know, that doesn't necessarily automatically.
Yeah.
But
so you're literally all on the same page. Was that the stage management's job?
We had to make sure that everybody got the pages. And I don't remember. I don't think we were the ones having to type it. I mean, obviously maybe it's not obvious, but when you're a stage manager and you're putting in blocking, all of that has to get transferred to the new pages. And when, as you're working the cue, that has to be, you know, added to the pages that are there. And there's a lot of making sure that things don't fall out. Like, so, you know, if there's business now that used to be in a different place or was never there, and those costume designer is going to need to know about it, or the, you know, you have to kind of keep that flow of information going.
And is that, like, would those be the sort of production notes every day at the end of rehearsal or at the end of a preview or whatever, you know, that such and such change happened, that this might affect these sort of ricochet effect down the line, other things?
Well, yeah, and also in rehearsal, you're watching with, you know, you're keeping an eye out because you're the person in the room that is in touch with all of the artists and craft people. You're trying to keep an eye out and just say, I don't know if this is going to affect you, but it might.
Right.
You know, so, and, you know, just the technical sort of busy work of stage managing, making sure that, you know, if an entrance has changed, that the prop they need is in the right place, and how does it get to another, and all of that, you know, just kind of watching for that to make sure that it's that just they're going to have what they need where they need it.
And with all of those, obviously so many props, but with the magic and all the special effects, was that all figured out in the rehearsal room and then put into practice during the tech rehearsal or rehearsals, or was stuff sort of predetermined outside the room by the designers or whatever?
Well, I know that the magicians, the two musicians, magicians who worked on that, so they had talked about it in the rehearsal room, and but it's hard to really picture the trapdoor and those kinds of things until you have them in 3D.
I mean, so nowadays we see these elaborate things, you know, especially for big musicals doing Broadway rehearsal processes with wheeled on kind of scaffolding looking contraptions that, you know, simulate a sort of lower tech, less fancy version of what Broadway pieces will be like. Did you have those kinds of pieces for Into the Woods rehearsal?
I'm trying to remember, like, Pam Rapunzel must have been up on something.
Yeah.
But I don't recall what it was. I'm inventing that it must have been some kind of rolling ladder that locked, you know, but I don't really remember.
And then would you and Frank and James and his team
Don't leave Jonna out of any of these.
Excuse me, no. And Jonna was extremely informative. I had a wonderful chat with Jonna. Would you, all of you together, was there some sort of like a dry tech process before the actors got there, where you sort of figured out the routining, the sequences of, oh, this is what the tower does, and on this piece of the music and that kind of stuff?
I was backstage. Mm. So Frank was out at the tech desk in the front of house with the designers and with James and Steve. So they may have had those conversations that were separate from me. You know, I was in the wing on one side of the stage, almost on the other side. I'm not sure. I don't know. The tech rehearsals have a lot of hurry up and wait.
Yeah. So, well, I want to get into the run a little bit, but just one more question about the material in and out in development, because there's these other demo songs that are some of them more like snippets. The group number, We Have to Give Her Someone, when they're waiting to whether to feed the Jack to the Giant or someone to the Giant, and the song Interesting Questions that the narrator sings, which we still hear the music of now. When he's given to the giant, but no one actually sings it. Did those songs get sung either in the workshop or in a preview or in rehearsal? Were they just scraps, you know, that were thrown away before they ever got staged, or did they ever have life?
No, I think that the whole argument about, you know, I think it's still in the show, isn't it? The argument about, you know, we'll give her so it's your fault, I guess. That's the number.
It's your fault. No, but there's that other song, We Have to Give Her Someone, that there's a demo of them singing. Like, maybe it was replaced by It's Your Fault. It's the witch arguing that they have to feed someone to the giant.
Yeah, I think it became incorporated into Your Fault.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And other little things that actually were recorded on the album but were not in the show, like the longer version of He's a Very Nice Prince, where the baker's wife and Cinderella have a sort of beautiful duet, sort of cast, you know, building up the same way that Agony does. And the witch's longer version of Lament that has a little more of that Stay With Me, I guess the bridge melody. Did those things last long in previews or were they ever performed?
I'm not the right person to ask. I'm just not. Paul would know.
Sure. Not either. I mean, everyone's just forgotten. I should have done this 20 years ago. So, okay. And then, so getting into the Broadway run, I know you had understudy rehearsals every week to stay ready. Do you remember the first time someone went on or any particular incidents of that process before it was sort of a well-oiled machine?
No, on Big River, yes, but not on, not on Into the Woods.
Yeah.
I know people weren't sure what their backstage business was going to be, like how they were going to get to their costume changes and all of that. When we had 4 stage managers, so when somebody went in for the first time, I would help. I would, you know, be there with them backstage to facilitate and make sure they kind of knew which way they were headed.
Did you not have to be sort of married to a station with a headset?
Somebody was calling the show. So it was a stage manager calling the show. There was somebody stage left. There was somebody stage right. And then there was a 4th stage manager. So when somebody went on for the first time, I was free to help them just be their ghost backstage and make sure that they knew where they were headed next. And then, you know, if one of us was calling the show, Frank could go out front and watch it and make sure that things were landing the way they were supposed to, and, you know, keep that, keep the show tight. You know, obviously with Musicians Union, the show has to run the same length, each night. You're trying to keep it close so that you don't run into overtime problems.
I understand that might've been a challenge when Dick Cavett was in the show.
Paul Gemignani is the master of that. He's the master of keeping the pacing going. We had that one, I'm sure somebody else has talked about it, but we had that one time when I think Pam talked about it, when the Rapunzel's Tower got stuck halfway and we had to just bring the show to a stop to fix it. And Cavett was just brilliant with the audience, talking, sharing things. They got their money's worth that day. That was quite entertaining.
Yeah. So Bernadette left the show kind of early. She had to go make her film Slaves of New York in the spring. After talking about the gift of having Bernadette, what was it like to recover from that loss as a company?
Well, I mean, we had Felicia Rashad to put into the show, and you know, she's brilliant and formidable, and had worked a lot in television. And when I was trying to give her the blocking, for me, it was all anchored to what the beat was, what the beat between the actors was. And she said, "No, tell me where I have to be. You know, give me the blocking, tell me where I have to be out," you know, and it made me see the show different. It's hard to explain how you went, because for me, it was tied to the motivation, but the character was so new for her. She created the character, and that wasn't the way I'd put anybody else into the show. So it was very interesting. And she said, no, you know, she'll have her conversations with Lapine about who the character is. So just give her her marks and the timing kind of. So whereas before I tried to make sure that people who were going into the show were going to fit into what was happening with the other actors. And because we rehearsed with understudies to get her in the show, and there were the put-in rehearsal was when it was really the chemistry between the characters was happening. So it was a very dynamic process. It wasn't like everybody mourned that Bernadette left. There was a lot of work to do to put Felicia into the show.
Yeah. Was it really just one put-in rehearsal?
They may have had two put-in rehearsals, but it wasn't much. Like we rehearsed, we had the understudy, you know, the rehearsals, blocking rehearsals with the understudies, but to put her in with the cast and with the tech and all of that.
Yeah.
I think it might have been one or maybe two, but those are expensive things.
So just for my clarity and for people ignorant like myself, like, so the understudy rehearsals are happening every week to keep the understudies fresh for if and when they have to go on in the various roles. And then when someone like Felicia is joining the cast, they join those understudy rehearsals to take advantage of this time with the understudies that's sort of already budgeted for and already scheduled, that the new cast member can play their part and do it opposite actors who are prepared to potentially be on with them. That's right.
Right. It's so they know the blocking and we're doing them on the stage,
yes.
But the stage is not, it isn't going to change. It's, you know,
yeah.
The stagehands aren't there to move things around, but so they're, we do the run through and work out the business and all of that. And then they have their put in rehearsal with the real cast.
And sorry, go ahead.
Just with understudies, because they often cover multiple roles, they, you know, it may take a couple of weeks before they're, you know, a rotation before they get to play each that they're responsible.
And that's only like 2 or 3 days a week that those understudy rehearsals happen.
I think it's, I don't remember if it's 2 days, it may have been just weekly understudy rehearsals more in the beginning.
Right. But I think it's not matinee days and it's not the day off.
Right. So I don't remember what day we had them, maybe Thursdays. I'm not sure.
And so, and then when you do have the put in, is that with the full orchestra and lights and everything, or?
That's an excellent question. I don't remember. I know it's with all of the scenery and I think with the lights. And Felicia was so aware of finding her light, hitting her spot, that it made me think, gee, I should be really paying attention to that when taking blocking for a show. So, because you know, by the time when they're doing the lighting design, I'm backstage. I'm not seeing where the exact spot where they landed, and that's where the light cue is. You know,
that interesting. Was
new for me.
Did that change? Because then after Felicia, you had several other. Well, you had lots of people coming into the cast in different roles, but certainly several people as the witch. Did that experience change the way that you staged them into it?
Yes. I mean, when Nancy Dussault came into the show, she was very, she was from a theater background. I mean, she'd done a lot of television, but she was from a theater background. So there wasn't the same kind of, you know, don't tell me, that's not your job to tell me that information. So it was much easier, much more familiar put in for her. What a lovely woman she is too.
Yeah.
Really
cool. Yeah. I loved talking to her. And it's funny because, both Nancy Dussault and Felicia Rashad were such sort of iconic TV moms that I grew up on in the 80s. But both of whom had theater backgrounds and originated in Broadway musicals. And then what about at the very end, Well, near the end, when the original cast members came back, when Bernadette and Joanna and I think a couple other people who'd left came back to film, how did that, how did you make that work?
Well, I had left and had a baby at that point.
Oh, mazel tov. Very, very belatedly.
Yes, now I'm a grandma. I wasn't there for that part of the run, very end. I was quite big and pregnant putting people into the show.
Wow.
The sweep with the baker's wife parts. It was quite funny. I think it was like a reunion to have people coming back.
And you did not go work on the tour, is that right?
No, I was a new mommy.
A new mommy. Wow. And have you revisited the show over the years? I either worked on other productions or even just seen them, watched the video.
I saw the tour in San Francisco recently. So wonderful. And several years ago, there was a kind of reunion of cast people that toured around, and I hadn't seen Danielle, I hadn't seen Ben Wright, I hadn't, you know, seen them for a very long time. So I saw them in Costa Mesa, which was quite, you know, fun. I loved that group of people. It was a very special, special group.
Yeah.
And a wonderful experience. And, you know, I just got a thrill. It was like every night you listen to the music, you listen to that, and you hear something new. There's just so much in the score. You know, this. Just a privilege, and what a lucky thing to be able to listen to those singers, those musicians for your job. I mean, it's really special.
I can only imagine. I mean, the impact that it's had on so many millions of us as fans, to actually have been a part of the creation and to be working on it 8 shows a week, all those months, the way that it must just live in your bones and in your cells and in your heart it must be so beautiful and intense. But thank you so much for sharing these memories with me. I'm so grateful for it. I'm so happy we got to chat.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for reaching out. And I'm sorry, my memory isn't better.
No, you're fantastic. I mean, truly everyone remembers only what they remember. Nobody can answer all the questions that I have. They probably will never get answered. And but I'm putting it together. You're a piece of that, and I'm very happy for it.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 54 with Eric Stern, co-musical director at the Old Globe.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.